Paul is the preacher this morning. If you have questions or issues you want to take up with him, he can be contacted by text or email, or if you're in the neighborhood, at Powell's Books in downtown Portland during open hours. If you have suggestions for the speaker as to how she might improve for the next time, forget about it. It's not going to happen again. That said, let's begin. The words of Qohelet, offspring of David, king in Jerusalem. This superscription frames the beginning of a remarkable book, unique in biblical literature. It reflects a crisis in ancient Israelite intellectual history, the end of wisdom, and attempts to redefine the nature and purpose of human consciousness, the end of wisdom. This brief introduction to the book draws attention to several important characteristics, themes, and phrases in the hopes of enticing and guiding independent readings of its intriguing texture. We should perhaps start with what may be the most disturbing passage in the entire book for assembly folks, Ecclesiastes 10:2. The heart of the wise inclines to the right. But the heart of the fool to the left. Wait, what? Must assembly reorient its political orientation to remain biblical? Must Carl reinstall his Fox News app and retrieve his flag lapel pin from the pawn shop? Must the assembly library be purged of offensive books? Thankfully, no. This is a good example of modern associations proving misleading. Of course, right and left here are not political designations, but simply indicate the endpoints of a continuum. The idiom reflects a certain right side bias present in many ancient cultures. Even the omen literature of ancient Mesopotamia tends to consider signs appearing on the right side as fortuitous and those on the left as ominous. The Inclusive Bible translates this passage more appropriately as, "The heart of wise people leads them aright. The heart of fools leads them astray." The designation Qohelet, which is the title of the Hebrew work, means something like gatherer of wise sayings of people, etc. The word is not attested elsewhere in the Hebrew Bible. It is worth noting that the form of the word appears to be feminine, though the voice of the author is depicted as grammatically masculine throughout. As noted in the Inclusive Bible, however, some scholars feel it may have originally been an office filled by a woman, or that the noun is feminine to indicate inclusiveness. Qohelet is not a personal name, but an epithet designating a sage, a wise one. Though written centuries after him, the superscription is intended to evoke the legacy of Solomon, whether as actual author or pseudonymously as authority. In his Two Horizons commentary, Peter Enns expresses the view shared by many scholars that Qohelet is a character created by the author to make a theological point, that is, a nickname adopted by the writer to maintain a Solomonic connection for his character while also distancing the character from the actual person. In the Septuagint, the 3rd century BCE translation of the Hebrew Bible into Greek, the term Qohelet was not transliterated as names typically were. Rather, a parallel equivalent was devised, Ecclesiastes, meaning simply a member of an ecclesia or assembly. Both words are based in their respective languages on verbs meaning to gather, assemble. Ecclesiastes became the title of the Greek version of the book, and was subsequently taken up into Latin and most modern translations. As Julie Duncan notes in her Abington commentary on the book, interpreters, ancient and modern, have differed on whether Qohelet refers to the function of one who convened the people to teach them, reflected in the traditional rendition of preacher, or to his collecting and arranging of proverbs and wisdom. Interestingly, the tribute of the epilogist at the end of the book is suggestive of both roles, remembering Qohelet as one who taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs. 12:9. The NRSV translation, teacher, seems to be based on this reference to Qohelet's pedagogical activity. As with many biblical books and ancient literature in general, there are few explicit internal clues about authorship and historical setting. In the case of Ecclesiastes, linguistic and literary features of the book suggest dates between the 5th and 3rd centuries BCE. Many scholars agree that the book is set in a time of turmoil. The text of the book seems to reflect conditions that were volatile politically, economically, and theologically. The periods of Persian and Greek domination of Israel-Palestine seem to provide the appropriate settings for the book's style and content. In his Believer's Church commentary, Doug Miller characterizes the book as a kind of philosophical notebook. There are a few precedents for this genre among the wisdom literatures of the ancient Near East. Though the text demonstrates some thematic and structural elasticity, this does not indicate a lack of coherence. Much of what we perceive as disjointed and even contradictory in this book may be attributed to such stylistic features. In its style, themes, phraseology, and structure, Ecclesiastes exhibits aspects in common with other wisdom literature of the Bible and the ancient Near East. Biblical books associated with the wisdom tradition, in addition to Ecclesiastes, are Proverbs and Job, along with the apocryphal books of Sirach and the Wisdom of Solomon. Together, they constitute a distinct, if diverse, corpus of works in the Bible. What sets them apart most strikingly, perhaps, is the lack of themes otherwise so prominent in the Bible: national deliverance and covenant, Exodus, peoplehood, and the conquest of the land. Instead, wisdom tends to focus on the domain of daily life and the fate of the individual. In wisdom, God is foremost the creator who has set natural and moral orders into the cosmos and society. Wisdom is derived not from revelation, but from observation and reasoning. Early wisdom tended to be aphoristic and conventional, as reflected in the book of Proverbs. Later wisdom, as reflected in Ecclesiastes and Job especially, came to identify the orders of creation with Torah and the law of reciprocity upon which it is built. It was the apparent breakdown in the conventional orders of society in times of crisis that led the writers of Ecclesiastes and Job to give expression to skepticism and protest. In this respect, they anticipate intellectual trends that we tend to associate with modern and postmodern alienation of humans from God and religion. What are the obligations of a modern reader of ancient texts, including the Bible? For one, we should be careful to avoid conflating the text of the Bible with the centuries of interpretation and sometimes misuse that have characterized its reception in communities of faith. Though reading the actual text of Ecclesiastes or any biblical book will not provide us with easy answers, it may help us to formulate better questions about the conventional wisdom of our day and our own glib assumptions. Ancient and biblical literature, and specifically, in this case, Hebrew writings, have their own conventions. And of course, the various genres have distinct features and modes of expression, which the process of interpretation must take into account. An educated person in our society, for example, knows to read a textbook differently than a newspaper, a website, an email, a text, or a street sign. It is no less important for the Bible. Commentaries and other forms of study tools provide guidelines for this kind of contextualized reading. A good rule for reading remains that application of inductive logic to literature. One asks of the text in this order: 1, what does the text actually say? 2, what might the text have meant in its ancient context? 3, does the text have any claim to truth relevant to our own context? It should not be assumed that every biblical text is in fact relevant to our lives. To determine this is part of the interpretive process. Christer Stendahl, Lutheran Bishop of Stockholm, groundbreaking professor of New Testament and dean at Harvard Divinity School, formulated a tribute to the Bible in a series of 5 no statements. 5 assumptions that came to guide his reading of Scripture. 1, it is not about me. 2, it is not as uniformly and comprehensively deep as we might think. 3, even the Apostle Paul isn't always sure what is right. 4, we shouldn't be so uptight and self-righteous about the Bible. And 5, it is not always as universal as we think. Within these parameters, Stendahl developed a critical and historical perspective that allowed him to punch through the doctrinal constraints that bound the text and freed him to apply its insights to his own life and work. Perhaps there are other guiding principles we might want to add. We should not impose our agenda on an ancient text, but try to let the text speak for itself. Let it identify its concerns, whether explicit or implicit. These may or may not reflect our concerns, but very often the concerns of the ancient writer are driven by aspects of the human dilemma that we share. And don't imagine that everything you read will make sense. Don't let apparent discrepancies or contradictions or incongruities preoccupy you or turn you off to the whole. Move on to the things that seem to make sense, and let that be your point of departure. Let the text be the other through whose eyes your own image becomes clearer. When it comes to the message or meaning of Ecclesiastes, one key is to be found in the oft-repeated phrase translated in the NRSV as vanity of vanities. It is found in the opening statement of the book, and again at the conclusion, and is used 38 times in the book overall. This traditional translation into English is unfortunate and somewhat misleading because of the shifting meaning of vanity in modern usage. The underlying meaning of the Hebrew word hebel is vapor, which Qohelet employs as a metaphor and symbol. It signifies lack of substance, transience, and absurdity. Peter Enns paraphrases the force of the Hebrew idiom as, "Everything is absolutely, and I mean absolutely, absurd." He goes on to paraphrase the essential message of the book in the following terms. This is what Qohelet is saying. At the end of the day, life is frustratingly absurd. The cycles of nature are screaming that message to you. You live, you exert a lot of energy, but nothing new happens. Just like the sun, wind, and rivers. Then you die. And one other thing, after you die, you will be quickly forgotten. Life as we experience it, in other words, is an affront to the reasoned orders we superimpose upon it. It sounds bleak indeed. It is not a message we want or need to hear every day. It is a facet of moral insight, functioning as a kind of reality check. But this is not the end of Qohelet's message. It is a kind of starting point. Stripped of our illusions, we may begin to engage with the here and now world. We discover our humanity, according to Qohelet, not by wresting control from God and determining our own fate, but by finding our place within the cycles of the cosmos. Only there can our toil find meaning. To everything there is a season and a time for every matter under the heavens. Almost certainly the most familiar passage of Qohelet is that poem of time and timing in chapter 3. Its rhythmic litany of antithetical pairs of opposites made familiar in our generation by the birds represents the totality and variety of life in creation. For Qohelet, God is the origin of this order and looms as the principle of stability and durability across uncountable generations of flora and fauna. From this perspective, humans are reminded of their essential creatureliness. Like all of life, we die and return to dust. Our flame flickers, burns, and is gone. Qohelet's God is the glue that holds it all together. And it may well be that his flabbergasted outcry will speak to us in the midst of our own absurdities. As the Quran wisely notes, there is no compulsion in matters of religion. Anna cannot make you read Ecclesiastes. What she and the worship committee have done is to provide us with an opportunity to acquaint ourselves with a book that marks a stage of the development of human consciousness, the realization that the cosmos will thwart all of our attempts to reduce life to our comfortable categories. So how are we going to live into and within that absurdity? One strategy might be, use the introductory materials provided and read the text of Ecclesiastes for yourself. Be people of the book, which doesn't really work unless we are people of books and ideas and words and actions and contradictions and blatant absurdities that our desperate toil only partially obscures. I encourage assembly folks to read the book and watch the introductory materials Anna provided. An interview with my graduate school colleague, Peter Enns, and an informative video by the Bible Project linked in the assembly line. Next week, Jim Stump on wisdom and foolishness. Prepare yourselves to learn from a real philosopher, a colleague of Qohelet, a fellow traveler in the quest to just make sense.